way over the time, so I do apologize for that. Supposed to be an hour and a half. We're trying to aim between an hour and 15 and an hour and a half, roughly, to do each session. There's a lot of introductions and to the topic and people and so forth. Now we're just going to get into the book. As I mentioned last week, just as a revision, we'll do a different book. This is my translation of a book called, actually the author never gave it a name. Others gave it a name called Ajub al-Jaliya. I've called it humbly Fiqh of Worship. I mentioned this last week, if you were in last week's session. So this is the translation. You can find it online on Amazon. And the book that we're actually doing, which I recommended for those who were not here last week, Bidayatul Abid of Sheikh John Starling translation. You can find this on Amazon as well. So it's called Bidayatul Abid. That's the name of the book. We went through the introduction in the first session. Anybody that was not here last week? So you, the ones that are here today, they were here last week. So I don't have to repeat anything, inshallah. So this is a recap through a different book. I'll go through it very quickly because there's a whole session last week which covers 90% of this book. This book is written by Sheikh Al-Qudumi, rahimullah, about 100 years ago. He passed away 100 years ago in Palestine, in Nablus. And he, rahimullah, basically is 500 masail of the same topic, which is ibadat, salat, tahara, salat, zakat, hajj, sawm, the four pillars, and tahara, of course, is related to that. So those five sections of fiqh, 500 masail from that, the most important masail that we need to know, and in 106 question answer, I think 106 question answer format. So we'll start, and I'll read through very quickly. This is not the actual explanation of the class. This is just a revision, a recap of last week. The same things that we covered last week, I'm just going to go through it quickly as a recap, and then inshallah we'll commence the actual class. Chapter on Tahara, purification, section on water. All praise due to Allah alone, and peace and blessings be upon the one after whom there is no prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. What is the definition of Tahara linguistically and in Sharia? Tahara linguistically means purification or cleanliness. In Sharia, meaning fiqh, the technical terminology of fiqh, it means lifting hadith, a state of impurity, meaning you might need wudu. When you wake up out of a sleep of the night, in the morning you need to make wudu. This is a state of hadith that requires to make wudu. It's called hadith. Or removal of khabath, actual physical impurity. For example, there is, let's say, urine on clothes. This is a khabath, is a najasa, physical impurity that needs to be. So these two together, lifting the state and the removing the physical impurity, is what's tahara according to the Sharia. As for hadith, it is of two types, akbar or asghar, major and minor. That which necessitates ghusl is called akbar, that which necessitates wudu is called asghar. How many types of water are there? We went through this last week in detail. Three types of water, tahur, tahir, and najis. So tahur, it is that water which remains in its original form, whether it descends from the sky or came from the ground, springs, wells, rain, snow, hail, etc. It is pure in itself and it can purify. So it's pure and it can purify other things, meaning you can use it for lifting hadith and removing khabath. It tahir, the second one, a large amount of water whose color, taste, and smell changes by mixing. So this is so the first one is tahur, that used for tahara. Tahir is not dirty, but it can't be used. So it's a large amount of water whose color, taste, and smell changes by being mixed with something pure, such as saffron, or putting a tea bag today into water or tea. It changes it. Now you actually can't call it water anymore. A small amount of water previously used for lifting hadith, for example, use water after collected in the container. So you make wudu, all the water is collected in the container. This water is not najis. You might spit into it, you blow your nose into it, everything, but none of the things from the mouth or the nose are najis. Therefore, the water can't be called najis. This is an extreme situation, something that we probably don't have to think about on a practical basis. But that water is collected. What can you do with that water? Can you use it for tahara again? No, this water is clean. It's tahir, but it's not mutahir. It's not purifying. A religiously obligated Muslim wakes up from nocturnal sleep and dips his hands into the water before washing it three times without niyyah and basmala. Basmala is to say bismillah. Doing this is wajib, can refer to the niyyah or basmala. This water is now pure in itself but unable to purify. A person wakes up from the nocturnal, so it's night sleep, he's a Muslim, he's reached the age of maturity, let's say, he's of sound senses and all those sort of things, he's like a religiously obligated Muslim mukallaf, and In the old days, they didn't have taps like that. They'll have a little bowl for wudu. Right now, we just make it off taps of the faucet. But in the old days, they would not have that. So this water is there. He puts his hands into it. The way you would do it is you first tip it out, say Bismillah, make niyyah, wash your hands. Then your hands are clean. Then you can take the water out of it. If you do this, this water is not dirty. It's not najis, but you can't use it for wudu anymore. It is permissible to use tahir water for eating and drinking, etc., but not for lifting hadith or removal of khabath, not even for istinja. Najis, this is different to, let's say, in the Hanafi madhab, where you can use even juice or other things that are not even water. In our school, in the Hanbali school, you can only use water for istinja. If you're going to use any liquid, it has to be water. Najis, it is that water in which najasa or filth drops, and it is small quantity. Water changing is not required. Right. So let's say you have a bucket of water, like 10 liters, a bucket of water. You have a bucket of water and it's 10 liters. Remember last week we talked about the two qullas, which is coming up, which is in around 200 liters, let's say, average it out. Basically two bathtubfuls, large earthen container, approximately of water. It's under that, right? 10 liters is under that. If a drop of urine, for example, drops into that, or a drop of blood, these are najis, right? If it drops into that bucket, that water is now najis. It can no longer be used. It cannot be used in the above, what we mentioned previously. Not tahir, it's not tahir, it's actually najis. If it's more than that qullatain amount, which is about 200 or so liters, and there's different measurements people have done, come to different conclusions, but we'll base it around 190 to 200, 216, as many Shafi'is say as well, liters of water. If it's more than that, let's say it's 500 liters of water and najasa, a drop of urine falls into it. Obviously, that drop of urine is so small, it will not change, have an effect on the water. Or even if it's something more than that and it still doesn't change the water, then it's najas thing that, unlike previously mentioned about tea and saffron, it doesn't change it. If it doesn't change it and it's a large amount of water, then that water is not najis. So this water cannot lift hadas nor clean. So if it's under that amount and it changes, right? If it's under that qullatain and najasa comes, even if it doesn't change, or it's larger than that and it changes, you cannot use it for hadas. Even if it's like a lake, if you're in a lake and so much sewage, let's say, flows into the lake, hypothetically, and then that smell of the najis, of sewage is najis, comes into the whole lake, the water of the lake, or the water, the taste or the smell, it changes so much. That whole lake cannot be used for tahara. A large quantity of water is two qullas or more. A qulla is a large container which requires strong men to carry it. One qulla is 71 and 3/7 nablus and is equivalent. A small quantity is anything less than the above. These are old measurements. Ruling of containers and parts of carrying. What type of containers are permissible to adopt? It is permissible to use every pure container except those made from gold and silver. Both are haram to use and adopt. So you can't keep them, and nor can you use them for, and can make wudu out of them. And so everything else than that, in this specific hadith that I mentioned about severe punishment, it's a major sin actually to use gold and silver containers. What is the ruling of the container and clothing of the disbelievers? They're pure as long as najasa is unknown. What is the ruling of the parts of on the parts? Generally, we'll be surprised at that, but we go by what is known. And what is known is that we don't know if there's najasa there or not. So we assume, we give the benefit of the doubt to the those clothes, and we say that these are tahir. What is the ruling on the parts of carrion? The bones and horns are najis, so is the skin. So you can see there's more detail in this book. The bones are and horns are najis. Carrion is the animal. Maita is an animal that has been killed in a non-zabiha way, slaughter way. So let's say in Australia here, we have a lot of kangaroos on the road. Kangaroos are halal, right? For those who might be from overseas. It's nothing special, but people do sometimes hunt them. If you're driving country, it's a regular sight on our roads to see dead kangaroos. So if an animal is the bones and horns, remember that animal, if it's killed without zabiha, like with a blunt instrument or something hit on the head, let's say knocked unconscious or knocked to death, then it's not no longer halal. So the bones and horns are najis. So is its skin, which cannot be purified with tanning. Only if the animal is slaughtered in a halal manner. This is specific to the Hanbali mazhab. It's not in the other three mazhabs. That an animal, any leather that we have, even if it's tanned, according to the official stance of the mazhab, even if it's tanned, it is still it's still not pure. It's not purified. In the other mazhab, if you tan it, you put it through the chemical process, go through the process of tanning, meaning processing the leather. It removes all the liquids out of it. It becomes a leather that's usable for jackets or shoes, etc. It's tahir in the other madahi, but not in ours. However, if it is tanned, it is permissible to use it for dry things, storing rain, not for liquids. You can see because it's still not tahir. For example, storing water or honey, which would be impermissible, nor can one pray on it. So it's not tahir for us. You can use it. It's something useful, strong, that can be used for dry things as a thing, but it's not tahir. Hence, certain ahkam in terms of mixing, putting liquid in it because the najasa will mix. And as for hair, wool, and feathers, they are pure even from carrion. Number one. Number two, for pure animals while they're alive. So sheep, for example, you shear the sheep and you get the wool off the back of the sheep. So while they're alive, from an animal that is not permissible to eat, for example, a cat. There you go. Ahkam of istinja. Let's go to the English. What is istinja and what are its rulings? It is to purify. The question there, I'll just quickly look. So I went through this last week. The leaders, look, let me, I think I put a footnote in the last one as well. 190 leaders is one mention. I mentioned this last week. There are several views on this. 190. About 200, some of the Shafi'i, Sheikh Musa Ferb, if you look at the books, and even Sheikh Wahab Zuhaili and Dr. Wahab Zuhaili and other ulama, there's so many different views on it. But roughly, if you say 190 to 200, I mentioned a few other ones as well, 216 liters, about 200 liters, right? So is the amount for qullatain. But this view, there are different measurements, and even among the Hanbalis as well. But let's say the 190 and 200, 16 for the moment, have that figure in your mind. What is istinja? So first, the ruling of water established, which generally we don't have to worry about because the water, we are pulling the water, we're getting the water from, not from wells or from buckets or rain. Generally, we're getting the water from our taps, which are coming from reservoirs. I think, I hope inshallah that that's the way you get your water. It is to purify oneself. So istinja, it is to purify yourself from the filth of the two orifices, the private parts, number one, number two, as we say, with pure water or a permissible stone or the like thereof. For example, rags. This is before the invention. Even this book is written 100 years ago. This is before the invention of toilet paper or the use of toilet paper in some parts of the world, maybe. And it is only mandatory on everything that exits the private parts as long as it is not semen, wind, or dry excretion resembling a pebble in dryness and hardness and does not pollute the surrounding area. We went through this last week. What is the prerequisite of a sound istinja? The prerequisite in cleanliness with water until the area returns to its original state as it was before it became filthy. And if it is with a stone, there does not remain any filth except that which can only be removed with water, right? So the skin of the anus, when you wash it, it goes back to what it was before if you wash it with water. That, like, it should be totally clean. You should not feel anything there. And secondly, but if you're not using water, let's say you only have toilet paper to use, then the what's after using the toilet paper, you don't have any, the only way you can clean it any further is if you use water. Wiping stones have the following conditions. Wipe three times the area that requires purity. This also applies to toilet paper as well. Excretion does not exceed beyond the normal area filth usually touches. So meaning that as you're using the stone or toilet paper, it should not spread further. Best way to distinguish is to use a stone first and then use water. What are the etiquettes of one who relieves himself? They enter with the left foot into the lavatory or the area that they're going to answer the call of nature and say, Bismillah, a'udhu billahi min al-khubuthi wal-khaba'ith. In the name of Allah, I seek refuge from the male and female jinns, and to exit with the right foot and say, Ghufranak, alhamdulillah, alladhi adhaba anni al-adha wa afani. Is a well-known dua, your forgiveness or praise are due to Allah who removed from me discomfort and blessed me with relief. And that's the dua for exiting. What is makruh and haram for one, when one relieves himself? It is makruh to face the sun and moon, to face into the wind, because the splashes will come onto you. Speaking, urinating in a container without necessity, urinating in a crack in the ground. I just put a footnote there. There could be animals, insects, or snakes. Into a fire, into ashes. It is haram to face or have the back to the qibla in the open air without a barrier. So meaning this is if you are out in the, you know, open ground, then you should have something as a barrier. It's haram to face and have your back, or you can face, be perpendicular to it. To relieve oneself on a path, to answer the call. This is obviously going to a time when there were, you know, generally there were no toilets. So even if someone has to go, is desperate to go to the toilet, then they should go in a place where it's not offensive to people. Or should not relieve themselves in a beneficial shade where people might collect and use the shade of a tree, or under a fruit-bearing tree for the same reason, to remain in the lavatory more than needed, right? And various reasons we mentioned last week, because it's a place of waswasa, jinnat, shayateen. There are health things. If you've seen, I mentioned last week, there's a video of when you flush, how much actual fecal bacteria, so that's, you know, you should cover the toilet seat when you flush, because it goes everywhere, right? So there are disadvantages. There are advantages of having a toilet in your house, but there's also disadvantages that if you're not, you know, for health reasons. So this is modern explanation of the benefit of spending less time in the where you answer the call of nature. It is permissible to urinate standing. One will not be exposed to anybody, or will not dirty oneself, but it's better to sit down. Sometimes you might be in a public toilet, or you're traveling, and depending on the country they're in, then pretty much it's international. Public toilets are very filthy. If you can't clean it, you can't sit, then it's permissible. Just you have to be careful the splashes of urine don't come onto the clothes. What is the ruling of siwak using the toothstick? When is it emphasized and what are the benefits? Siwak is a sunnah at all times. However, it is makruh for the fasting person after zenith. We explained that last week as well. There is a huge difference of opinion on that, but the official stance of the school is that this is the official stance, that is makruh after midday. It is emphasized at time wudu, before salat, reading the Quran, waking from sleep, after change of mouth odor, bad breath, entering the masjid, entering the home, prolonged silence, and the yelling of the teeth, and having an empty stomach. Its benefits are many, such as it helps digestion of food, strengthens the gums. The greatest of all, that it will aid in reminding of the shahada at the time of death. Just one thing regarding the siwak, Dr. Mutlaq mentioned this, that we mentioned last week, we're using left hand. That's one thing. Other thing is, it's not something that you do around while you're around, out and about with people. So the miswak is something you do in the bathroom or when you're doing your wudu, like that. But it's not like something to be done because you're removing dirt out of your mouth. It should not be done like in sort of as a public display, right? And also, you don't have to put it in the pocket here to stick right up here so the whole world can see. It's not for people. It's you're following Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, right? So it's for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It'd be kind of strange, you know, having your toothbrush in your pocket, right? So it's some might consider it dawah, I don't know. But I've heard from ulama that they took it out. One of the brothers in Australia, one of the ulama came from overseas, he had it right here and displayed, and he took it out and he gave it to me, his hand, put it in your pocket, because this is not for people, it's for Allah. So anyway, it is sunnah to shave the, so these are the personal sunnahs or personal grooming. To shave the pubic region, trimming or using chemicals are also sunnah. To pluck the armpits, hairs, clip the nails, fingers and toes, utilize a mirror, use ithmid, antimony, kuhul every night. Trim the moustache, including the sides, very short. So it's talking about the sides here. So the moustache is what's above the lip. And so you can leave it as long as it doesn't dangle over the lips. But in the madhab, it is preferred that to trim it, not shave it, but trim it excessively, that it goes right down. Like so it's sunnah to do that, according to many schools. I think the Hanafis allow it shaving even the moustache. But to trim it down, right down. You can trim the, there's a question asked, you can trim the pubic hairs, but what it mentioned, the halqul ana, the word Rasulullah SAW specifically uses, shaving, so it should be shaved. Wallahu alam. It is haram to shave the beard, but it's permissible but not advisable to trim that which exceeds a fist length. So unfortunately, mine doesn't reach that far, but you can imagine it. So just so cut it that so like you leave it long, but you should bring minimum should bring it down to a fist length. The rulings of wudu. How many fard actions are in wudu? There are 6 fard actions in wudu, and they are washing the face, which includes rinsing the mouth and nose, washing both hands up to and including the elbow. So when we say washing the face, that's the first action that is compulsory, right? The fard. Second is washing the arms. We're talking about the hands up to and including the elbow. So this is not including the hands at the beginning of wudu. This is the second action after washing the face, including the mouth and nose. There's a definition of an elbow. I think all of us know it's this bone here that connects the upper arm and the forearm. Wipe the outside of the entire head, which also includes both ears and the area above and around the top of the ears where hair grows. So up and around here. So this, in the Hanbali mazhab, it's the whole head, right? Or where the hair is, right? In other schools, in the Shafi'i school, it's a few hairs on the front. Hanafi school, the minimum is a quarter, like the forelock. But in the Hanbali school and the Maliki school, it's the whole head. If you wipe the whole head, let's say if you are a Hanafi, if you wipe the whole, it's a sunnah according to their school, you've covered all the madahib, right? So if you follow the Hanbali mazhab in this masala, you've covered all the madhabs and you follow the sunnah, inshallah. And washing both feet up to including the elbows, the ankles, which is the bone protruding from each side. We're coming to that, inshallah. And to maintain the order, so you got the 4 limbs, face, including mouth and nose, arms, from the tip of the fingers till the up to including the elbow, and wiping the whole head, and including the ears and around the ears, and the last one, the feet up to the ankles. To do so in order, this is the 5th one, E and F, to do so without long interruptions, right? What is wajib necessary in wudu? Only tasmiyah, saying bismillah, is wajib. So saying bismillah is not fard, it's wajib. It is excused if it is left out forgetfully or in ignorance, but not so if it is left out intentionally, meaning that if you know that you have to do bismillah, that it's wajib bismillah, and you omit it intentionally, then your wudu is not valid. You don't have wudu. But if you did the whole wudu, and remember, I didn't say bismillah, you washed your feet, and you finished, I didn't say bismillah, the wudu is fine. How many prerequisites does wudu have? It has 8 prerequisites, which are ceasing of that which necessitates wudu, such as urination, passing wind, menses, and the like thereof, intention, right? These are the prerequisites before. Intention, to be Muslim, to be sound of mind, to reach the age of desertion, which is reaching 7 years of age. It says 7 years of age. In other books, it doesn't mention specify the age. What it says is that at age before the age of puberty, where one can distinguish between right and wrong. So it's like an in-between childhood and actual puberty, right? It's between these 2 ages. Pure water acquired legally. Remember last week that stolen water, you can't make, if you did wudu, it would not be valid. The removal of anything which prevents water reaching the body, such as wax or dough and paint as well. Istinja, cleaning the prior parts with water, or istijmar. This is a prerequisite you do before wudu, right? So if you went to the toilet and you didn't do istinja, your wudu is not going to be valid. So these are preconditions, shurut, before the act. How many sunnahs are there in wudu? It has 18 sunnahs, and they are facing the qibla, using the miswak, washing the hand 3 times. However, for those who wake up from a nocturnal sleep, then doing so is wajib with intention of saying bismillah. So there's 3 things there. It is wajib. There's an extra one for the fajr. Let's say we sleep a normal night of sleep and we wake up in the morning for fajr. We need to make wudu. It is wajib to make bismillah, make a niyat and bismillah, and to wash the hands, as was mentioned previously in regards to the water, tahir water. Rinsing the mouth and nose before washing the face. So to do that in order. So remember, the face, the mouth and nose is part of the face. But if you did the mouth first, and then the nose, and then the face, the order within that. But if you did it the other way around, you wash the face first, then the mouth and nose, your wudu will still be valid. So the order matters in the four actions, not within the actions within. To do more than the required for both the mouth and nose, except for the fasting person. So to do mubalagha, to exaggerate, or to do extra to make sure, really like wash the mouth out, wash the nose out. Except for the fasting person, because the water can possibly break the person's fast by going down the nose. To be thorough in cleaning all the limbs, increase in water for the face, as there are wrinkles, crevices, and beards, a beard on the face. Combing a thick beard with wet fingers once, running wet fingers between the fingers and toes. So like doing between that and like between, if you just imagine that's the foot, like your small finger sort of like going like that. Taking new water for the ears, right limb to precede the left for hands and feet, to exceed beyond the fard area for the four limb fard limbs, to wash a second and third time, keep the intention until the end of wudu, make the intention when washing the hands, and to pronounce the intention silently. Now, he says this is sunnah. There's a problem with that, because is there any proof for that? And I put a footnote there. The research scholars have pointed out there is no hadith text establishing the sunnah to vocalize, to seek. When you say silently, meaning with words, there's the ulama have said otherwise. And to say the following dua while raising the gaze to the sky after wudu, you can ashhadu la ilaha illa wahdahu wa la sharika lahu wa anna muhammadan abduhu wa rasuluhu, allahumma ij'alni min at-tawwabin ij'alni min ibadikas mutatahhirin. You can go to the dua books and find. Read Surah Qadr, there is a riwayah, but all the scholars have said of hadith, the research scholars said that this is not a reliable narration and cannot be said to be sunnah. Inna anzalna fi laylatil qadr, to be recited. To do the wudu without assistance, right? From somebody else doing the wudu for you. Inform me about the complete description of it. This is now the wudu from beginning till end, with all the fard and sunnahs, wajib, everything put together. His description is to make the intention of wudu for salat. Then say bismillah. Not bismillah rahman rahim, just bismillah. Wash hands three times. Rinse the mouth and nose three times each. Wash the face three times from the top of the forehead to the bottom of the chin and ear to ear. Wash the arms up to and including the elbow three times. Wipe the whole head, passing wet hands from the front of the hairline to the nape, and wipe them back from the nape to the front. To insert the index fingers in the ears and wipe the back of the ears with the thumbs, like that, right? To wash the feet up to and including the ankles three times. So this is the complete description of wudu from beginning till end. Wiping on socks, leather socks, khufs, it is permissible with seven prerequisites, and they are to wear them after complete purification with water. That is after wudu. So after you've completed washing both feet, then you, not one feet, both feet, then you put them on. They cover the area of the foot that needs to be washed, including the ankles. The possibility to walk around in them. You don't have to walk so many miles. Just if you can, they can be on your foot and you walk around. They remain in the foot by themselves. It is permissible to use, not stolen, usurped, or made from. So it's permissible to use. So it's permissible. So you haven't acquired them in the haram way. Leather that is pure, that is slaughtered or hunted Islamically and then tanned as well. A halal animal that has been killed in a halal way and then tanned as well. Cannot see skin through them, right? So then, of course, the question will come, can we use socks? Yeah, if the above conditions meet as well, waterproof is not a condition. However, there are, in the Hanbali ulama, majority do say, I'm talking about contemporary ulama, that you can wipe on them. However, there are some that consider should avoid wiping them. They should not be see-through. They should not be very thin, right? Wallahu alam. How long will masa last? It is permissible for the resident and the sinful traveler intending evil, like his journeys for the reason of evil, to wipe for a day and a night from the time that he breaks his wudu after wearing them, that is 24 hours after breaking wudu. It is permissible for the travel of a journey in which one can shorten prayers to wipe for 3 days and 3 days and nights, so 72 hours. And the distance of shortening is 2 moderate days with light luggage and walking approximately 80 kilometers. You probably see these 78, 80 different kilometer distances are given. It is wajib to wipe most of the upper portion of the khuf. The bottom of the foot and heel does not need take the place of the top, nor is a sunnah. some people, Nick. No, in the Hanafi fiqh, the wiping of the neck is a, there's a riwayat for it, but the other three, as far as I know, the other three madahib don't fall, but in the Hanafi fiqh, it's a thing. And some imams, like Sheikh Abdul Qadir Jilani, great imam of the Hanbali school, rahmullah, in his book, I was surprised to see that as well. So, I mean, if you just, if you're wiping on your head and you just go down, not as a separate act, it sort of covers that already, wallahu alam. Because you wipe right to the bottom, especially right to the neck, so wallahu alam, it covers that. Cotton socks permissible, that's what I mentioned, with the conditions that, I hope that clarifies that, inshallah. What breaks the wiping of the khuf? Three things. That which necessitates ghusl. If you need to make a ghusl, let's say a person, Oh, interesting. 85 miles. I don't know. I always learned that it's 80 kilometers, but I'll have to have a, in the actual original of the book, or a footnote. No, I think I'll wait for, if you can make a comment, it'll be, okay, interesting. Wallahu ta'ala a'lam. Wallahu a'lam. I'll follow that up, inshallah. I'll make a note of it, inshallah. Then what are you doing here if you study with the man himself? it came to check if I'm teaching correctly or not. All right. What annuls the wiping on the khufs? Three things invalidate ghusl, that which necessitates ghusl, or some of the area that the khuf should cover, that is the feet and ankles become exposed, or the end of the period of wiping. So as soon as it finishes, not just that the khuf masa breaks, actually the wudu breaks. Right? Is it permit? Just move the chat out of the way. Is it permissible to wipe on other than khuf? Yes, it is permissible to wipe on jabira, splint, which is wood, rags, or bands that are tied to a bone fracture or a wound. Now, here's inform me what is the ruling wiping on them. If it is applied while in a state of tahara, all right, inshallah, you accidentally got stuck in this class. You don't have to, inshallah. If it is applied while in a state of tahara and it does not go beyond the place of necessity, he washes everything and wipes on the wound. It goes beyond the actual wound and there is harm in taking it off, it is wajib to make tayammum with the wiping. If he placed it without the state of tahara, then he washes everything else and he makes tayammum without wiping, whether it exceeds beyond the wound or not. I went through this last week as well. Sections on the invalidators wudu. What breaks wudu? So eight things break wudu. That which exits from the two orifices, najis exits from the rest of the body, losing one's senses through insanity or intellect, for example, sleep or the like thereof, which is generally not considered if it is short sleep, when firmly seated or while sleeping, while standing. Touching the private. Once, you know, I was in Melbourne. I don't know if anybody's from Melbourne, in Preston Mosque in Fajr in the 90s. And there's a brother praying the stuff, young Somalian man praying in front of me. And he was with his friend and he fell asleep in Fajr Salat and he collapsed right in front of me. So you can fall asleep. He's standing for a long time, apparently. But apparently got him at the end. But so you can fall asleep during Salat, I guess, standing up. I can't even sleep sitting down, let alone I have to lie down. But some people can sleep even standing up. Some people fall asleep in sajda. Touching the private parts of a human, whether the penis or vagina or the anus, with the hand without a barrier. Touching the skin of the opposite gender with lust, whether the one touched is dead, old, or a mahram. Washing a corpse or some of it. Eating of a camel meat, not organs or its soup or gravy, curry, even if it is raw. Becoming an apostate from Islam, Allah protect us with Allah's safety. Everything that necessitates ghusl necessitates wudu except death. What is the ruling for one who doubts his tahara? Whoever is certain of his state of purity but doubts his impurity, or is certain of his impurity and doubts his purity, then you should act on what he's certain. What is forbidden for one who's in a state of impurity? Is forbidden for the one in a state of impurity, whether it is major or minor, salat, tawaf of the Kaaba, touching of the Mus'haf Quran without a barrier. And for the one in the major state of impurity, meaning if they need ghusl, it is like if they, after intercourse or she's in a haid, it is forbidden, according to the madhab, to recite the Quran from memory, even if it is a verse or more. However, the basmala or any dua which appears in the Quran may be recited with the intention of dua. Staying inside a masjid without wudu. So if a person in major impurity performs wudu, he may stay in the masjid. All right, I think that was it for... that's where we're up to. So that was just a recap for last week, and we took up half the time. There's a lot of masail in there. If you notice, that's the book is, we're doing course for 12, and we did 25 questions out of 100 from that book. So we covered like actually a quarter of the book. So there was a lot of masail in that first section, or the first half of Tahara. If one is in a state of major impurity, yeah, we're going to get to that, inshallah, as the we're going to do ghusl this week, and we're going to do next week as well, revision of it from the other, this book, the one I just showed you. Let me just get the slides up for this week's lesson. You can ask questions in audio as well, or you can type it, it's up to you. But okay, one second. Is anybody here from Australia? Okay, who's that? Alhamdulillah, someone came from Australia. Alhamdulillah. All right. Oh no. Who did you get in contact with? And you're not from Australia? Okay. Kakusi. That's all I know. Doburo and Kakusi. Alhamdulillah. Alhamdulillah. Brother from Bosnia, mashallah. The three types. Sorry, there's questions here, brothers and sisters, if there's just a question here. I'm just reading the question. Money is tahir. I don't understand what you mean by three types. I think you might be referring to money, wadi, and madi. So madi is najis. Madi is money, semen itself that comes out of result of wet dream and out of ejaculation, right? So it's tahir. But madi, which comes like precocial fluid before intercourse due to foreplay or whatever, and something comes out. So that's najis, right? That's treated like urine, put it that way. So it's like the and this is the same in the Shafi'i school as well. It's seen as like, you know, what comes out of your nose, as I mentioned earlier, is tahir. It's not najis. But if you had it on your clothes, it wouldn't be nice. So you still have to wash it off. So at the end of the day, in action, it's just that one believes both wash it. The Hanafis or those who have the view that it is najis, and those who believe that it's tahir, both of them, they wash it. In action, they both do the same thing. It's just that one views it like, no. We're not talking about ghusl. We're talking about, you asked about money. So you still need to make ghusl. It's just that if any money is there, the money would not be najis. We should still wash it off. That's according to all, like some believe that it's najis, some believe, but all wash it, right? As Rasulullah ﷺ did. You understand? It's like if you have something from your nose on your clothes, right? That's not najis, but it's not nice having it on your nice shirt, right? As an example. But if you had a wet dream, and obviously there's ejaculation there, it's you have to have ghusl. So that's ghusl is separate. The thing that caused it is needs ghusl, but itself it's not najis. I hope that's clear, inshallah. Let's get start the slides, inshallah, for this week. Bismillah. Okay. I won't read the Arabic because time constraints. And I think most of you don't read Arabic. And if you get the book, you have the Arabic in there. I'll just put it there in front of you that at least there are 70 mandatory causes for ghusl, which include the following. Number one, discharge of orgasmic fluid. Ghusl is obligatory even if it is mere moving is sensed and ejaculation is prevented. Right. So if someone was to, so orgasmic fluid, I don't think I have to explain to you. Someone has an orgasm, right? Someone has an orgasm. So then that can come out of a wet dream or come out of intercourse. Ghusl is obligatory, even if it is the mere moving sense, meaning that a person, that the semen moves from its place where it is and it moves, that you feel, you sense the movement. And even if the ejaculation, someone holds their, obviously referring to a man, holds their private parts and stops it coming out, even then ghusl is necessary. If ghusl is thus performed and then without lust, it discharges, ghusl is not repeated. Let's say somebody afterwards, it comes out, the semen comes out, let's say after ghusl, then it does not, a ghusl doesn't need to be repeated. It's ejaculation, even if bloody from its location, with consideration due to maybe sickness, with consideration given to an orgasm or someone not sleeping, etc. So for someone, the sleeping part is, for the sleeping person, if the sleeping person, he experiences, like before he didn't have any, foreplay before he slept. Like he didn't have actual intercourse, just had foreplay, but he didn't have foreplay before he slept. And then he woke up with something, let's say he's wet, then this is considered that he needs to make ghusl for this. If he had foreplay before that, then there's a possibility that what? It could be madhi or precocial fluid. And if it's precocial fluid, then that doesn't require ghusl. After sleep, because there's a possibility it could be something that is not necessary ghusl, then the benefit of that is that he doesn't need to make ghusl. If he has foreplay before it, and then after he wakes and finds something wet there, then he assumes that he doesn't need ghusl. But if he didn't have foreplay and then he wakes something wet, then he has to make ghusl. The insertion of the penis head or its equivalent into a primary, let's say it's the penis head is cut into a primary sexual opening, including an anus. Now, these are hypotheticals. This is not, of course, all of these things are haram, forbidden in Islam. But if it's into the primary sexual opening or into the anus, even that an animal or a corpse, and of someone with whom intercourse is performed even while asleep. These have been mentioned here, hypothetically, that these are the things that can make your ghusl break based on the fact that someone inserts into the private penis head into the private parts. So this, some people might hear this, go, what's it, what they're talking about? This is the fuqaha, the ulama wrote everything. Like they were much more, I don't know, they were less Victorian than we are today sometimes. When I wonder, like, you know, my teacher, one of my teachers in madrasa, I was studying the it was a long time ago, 2003, and he's a very senior. So his sons are in my class. So he got up. I had to teach this to 15-year-olds, 14 and 15-year-olds. He just got up. He's a very senior alim and mufti. Allah give him good health. He's quite advanced in age. But he said, you teach him. And he walked out of class. And I'm looking at this, how I'm going to teach these good boys, the Hafiz al-Quran, the very innocent boys. I have to explain all of these things in one go. In this one sentence, there's so many things you have to cover. 5 minutes I looked at it, I said, I'm about to shatter these boys' innocence by explaining all these things to them. But anyway, alhamdulillah, got through it and I asked them, do you have any questions? They said, no, they're red in the face. And they're so these are things that fuqaha have written. This is generally all across all madahib, they write like this. And so there's no questions left because people will ask questions. And of someone with whom intercourse is performed, even while asleep, if intercourse happens while asleep. Acceptance of Islam by a disbeliever, even they're an apostate, Allah protect, and or have done nothing which requires ghusl while in a state of disbelief. Meaning, if a teenager who's never had a wet dream or anything like that, or never had intercourse his whole life, so there's nothing in his life that happened that required him to have fard ghusl, he has to make ghusl when he accepts Islam. This is the ghusl for kufr, coming out of kufr into Islam. The discharging, it's not a ghusl for janaba, right? The discharging of menstrual blood, the discharging of postpartum blood, nifas. So haid, when the period finishes, it's compulsory to have ghusl to purify, and after postpartum blood. Sorry, I'm having a problem with these this program. Okay. The discharging of postpartum blood, it is not required for delivery absent of bleeding, if it's possible. Allah alam. I mean, someone might have asked the question or mentioned a case. If a baby is born without any bleeding, there is no ghusl required. But this is, Allah alam, if this is even possible. But it could be a rare case, something like that could have happened. And death, a cause for which ghusl is purely devotional, of other than the martyred in battle or the wrongly killed. So this is a obligation, not on the person. All the other ones are upon the person themselves. This is for everybody else. That if somebody, a Muslim, dies under normal circumstances, they're not killed wrongly in zulm, like as they're killed in oppression, or they're not shaheed in battle, then they are given a ghusl as we do with our dead. The prayer place for Eid, not for funeral prayers. Now, the Sheikh, for whatever reason, didn't mention here masjids. So this ruling also applies to masjid. It should actually more first be masjid and then for these things. The prayer places for Eid, not for funeral prayers, is considered a masjid in which seeking commercial profit is prohibited. So the what we call the Musalla of Eid, or in subcontinent, they call it Eidgah, the Eid grounds. In the Hanbali fiqh, they treat it like a masjid. You can't do trade there, and you got to treat it. You can't enter there in a state that you need ghusl in. You got to treat it like a masjid. For those who've been to Madinah Munawwara, if you go to the where Masjid Abu Bakr is, that's the place where Rasulullah led salat, I believe, for Eid and Istisqa, for rain and so forth. Right. Like it wasn't done inside the masjid, the Prophet's masjid. The prerequisites or the preconditions for ghusl. Cessation of what requires it. So the thing that causes it, that should stop. Intention, you make intention of ghusl. It should be, these three are the same as wudu. Islam, sanity, to be sound of mind. To be Muslim, to be sound of mind. Discernment, to reach that age where you can differentiate between right and wrong. Purifying permissible water. Remember, tahur water, that is the water that you can use. Permissible, it's from halal source, not stolen water. And removal, whatever prevents its contact. So these last four or five, they're the same as wudu, right? It is obligatory that water wet the entire body. This is the difference. Along with the inside of the mouth and nose, as well as what appears of a woman's vulva when she sits to relieve herself. So basically the external body, including the mouth and nose, right? So that which is considered external are these things. Water encompasses all of these, along with all the previous conditions. Is a prerequisite for ghusl. Assumption is enough for completeness. Just a second. like there's a sickness, people, you know, OCD, a type of OCD that can become like it requires actually treatment, like that there are ulama that suffer from as well. They can go make wudu. I know people, and I went through it as well personally, and it but what you do is you have to give yourself the benefit of doubt. That's why I'm talking to a faqih, a jurist, one of my teachers, humbly faqih teacher, he said, do it three times and that's it. Two of my teachers said this, that he goes, do it three times and now give yourself the benefit that it's correct. Like say it out loud, it's correct according to the deen or something like that. Because you have to overcome this, because you can wash it. Sometimes people spend 10 minutes, 20 minutes. And shaitan does this, like he whispers, right? He whispers to the, like he wants to disturb us. He makes tahara misery, then he makes salat a burden, and then he attacks the most ultimate, most valuable things at iman. So we have to start with tahara, like we don't let him give him inroads. If we do all the sunnahs and everything, we assume that we've fulfilled the obligation, and Allah will accept it, inshallah ta'ala. Same thing goes for salat. Sometimes Dr. Mutlaq, teacher, he was explaining about this, that salat, when it reaches a point, the waswasas reach, you can't remember your rakats. Three, you do, like you have to pray four rakats, like you do five, six, seven, eight, becomes ridiculous, right? One is understandable, right? But it becomes, people go through this. They can spend like a very long time. They can pray up to eight, nine rakats and think they haven't prayed enough. So these type of, that type of waswasa, you have to sort of, you have to assume that I prayed four and do salam. That's Dr. Mutlaq said, like you have to, in that severe case, that's what you have to do. That you have to give yourself a benefit of the doubt. Under normal circumstances, forget, sort of miss, all right, yeah, I'll do such a, you know, I'll do, I think I prayed extra rakat, whatever. But under, when he gets to that severe level. So to avoid, just assumption is sufficient for completeness. Whoever intends either recommended or an obligatory ghusl will be suffice for the other. So if a person does, you know, a sunnah, let's say you're doing a ghusl for janaba, a person has needs to do fard ghusl, and then it's Thursday night or it's Jummah day, then they make the intention for the sunnah will suffice for the fard one as well. One intention will suffice for the other. There's a shari'i reason for doing this, which is a sunnah of Jummah. It will suffice for the other as well. Whoever intends either a recommended or an obligatory ghusl will be suffice for the other. Sleeping while sexually impure is disliked without wudu. Right, so it's makruh, so haram, but after intimacy, person should make wudu. There are two riwayats, one of Umar radiallahu anhu, and Umar radiallahu anhu, he said that he asked Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and Rasulullah said that when somebody has him, he should make wudu. While Aisha radiallahu anhu narrated that I saw Rasulullah sleep, and he did not make wudu. To combine the two, when where one Rasulullah forbid, or he discouraged it, then this is taken in the meaning of it's makruh, it's not, and because the other hadith allowed it. Right, so and there could be different reasons why he didn't do it, to show that it's not haram, or sallallahu alaihi wasallam, or that the water might not be easily available, or that it's cold or dangerous, or whatever. There could be a myriad of reasons. Constructing bathhouses, selling and renting them, residing in them, and giving greetings of peace in them is also disliked, but not dhikr. Constructing bathhouses, hammam. Now, in Arabic, when the word hammam is used, it could mean two things. It could mean bath, today what we call bathroom, where we have a shower or a bathtub and a sink, etc. Or in the old days, hammam meant a public bathhouse. They call them hammam, actually, even in English as well. If you go to generally the Middle East, especially in Sham and Turkey, it's a Turkish thing, if I remember correctly, Palestine, you'll find these bathhouses. Basically, it's a place to go. There's a person there that you can hire that can scrub you really well. But the problem, why it's disliked, generally these places, the awrah is exposed, right? People expose themselves. It's something I think the Muslims, when the Muslims conquered former Sham, Syria, and these lands, that the Romans, they had this custom, but they used to go into naked, right? So when the Muslims came, of course, they cannot do this. So these public bathhouses, people go there to have a ghusl, to clean themselves, wash themselves. As is generally in our deen, this is something that is, you know, we very particular about that. So, but constructing these bathhouses, selling and renting them, residing them and giving them, all these things are disliked because But not dhikr, because that's open all the time. The thing is that these places, majority of things done in there are wrong. It's not that the actual bathhouse is wrong, but the majority of people in there, they're exposed. You see this very, you probably, those who go to swimming pools, right? Muslims, when they organize, like in the West, we have swimming pools that we hire for events, like so Muslims can go swim. But the problem is, if you've ever been to one of those sort of swimming pools, majority of the, not majority, maybe a very large percentage of the Muslims that go there, they don't know the basic ahkam of covering the awra for the men between the navel and the knee, right? And so then what's happening is they're committing a sin by exposing themselves, and you're committing a sin by seeing it. That's probably the closest equivalent is like saunas and local swimming pools and the way that the Muslims conduct themselves in those places. I'm talking about Australia. I'm not sure about in other countries, but generally you'll see Muslims are not very particular or they're very, there's a lot of jihadat regarding how they should be dressed. And this goes both for men and women. Women, of course, we hear about it from our mothers and sisters, what happens, unfortunately. But it is permissible. So it's not talking about bathrooms that we have today. This is talking about a public place where people go to bathe because people didn't have these things in their houses. It's not really a thing that we need today because we have our own homes. Maybe the hukum of this is applicable to these pools in the way that I mentioned. It is permissible to enter them while clothed and secure from the occurrence of something impermissible, disliked if otherwise. So it's not totally disregarded because we need to wash ourselves, clean ourselves, bathe ourselves. But as long as these conditions are fulfilled, disliked if otherwise feared and impermissible if known, or if a woman were to enter without justification, right? And there's a hadith about that that Rasulullah ﷺ said about a woman that enters, removes her clothes in a place where, other than a home, that really is not appropriate. Islamic ethically will not be, from akhlaq point of view, will not be appropriate. I worry sometimes because there's security cameras, companies are watching these places as well. There's companies that they've hired to watch their, you know, for safety and whatnot. And there's men sitting there and there's women that are at the swimming pool, but the security companies are all men pretty much, as far as I know, because I've family worked in this industry. And so how is that, you know, is that justifiable? Tayammum is a specific, so the next act is, so now these are all the things that we do clean with water. I think there's some questions. With water, now we're coming to that which when there is absence of water, what do we do? We can't use water. Okay, Jazakumullah khair for pointing that out. So in, Brother Ahmed, he said that Islam, sanity, discernment, they're all actually a condition for every act of worship in the madhab except for discernment for Umrah. And the question was about the foreplay. So I'll explain again. So if a person has foreplay before sleep, they didn't have intercourse, they just had foreplay. Then they slept. Then they woke up and they felt something wet, something had exited from the private parts. Then he doesn't have to do ghusl because he had the foreplay before. It's possibly, most likely it's madhi. However, as for a person who didn't have foreplay before, then he slept. Then he woke up, he was asleep and something wet. This is assumed to be, then he needs to make ghusl. We assume that this is money. So tayammum is as a replacement for when there is absence of water. So this takes the place of all the previous cleanliness that we did. They're all to do with water. This is the replacement. When we don't have water, we can't use water. Tayammum is a specific application of the earth on the face and hands as a replacement for water-based purification due to a legal inability, except for filth not found on the body or remaining in the masjid due to a need. So just explain that. So firstly, you hit soil, the earth, the ground where there's dirt, that's, you know, dirt that sticks to the hand. So you hit it, and the way it's wiped is that you use the front of the fingers to wipe the face, right? And then to wipe the cross, you know, stretch as much as possible across the face, number one. Then you take, because we never have to do this, right? So we always forget that. Then you wipe, this is the left hand here where my watch is. You put the hand and you wipe the back of the right hand, usually wiping the right, and then you and move the fingers in between like that, and that's it, right? And then you do the same for the other side, and that's the massage. Those are the two things that you do. That's what's a tayammum. I hope that's clear, inshallah. Right. So that's the first part. And it's for wudu. It's the same tayammum format of tayammum pretty much in this for wudu, for ghusl, and also for najasa on the body if you can't remove it. Right? Because you use water for wudu. It was water for ghusl. You use water for removing najasa. But not for najasa that's not on the body, right? Or remaining in the masjid due to a need. So like if you use the, yeah, like you, if tayammum can allow you to do everything, but entering the masjid, because it's not real, like for janaba, someone has janaba. No, I just mentioned it. Those two actions only. There's no, for four parts. This replaces the whole wudu. It replaces the whole ghusl. So there's no, the wiping is only done, as I mentioned, on the face and on the hands. And it's for us, it's up to and including the elbows. It's not even the arms as well, right? Those two acts, the face, wiping the face with the fingers and then wiping the, like that, that's it. That's the whole tayammum. That replaces wudu, that replaces ghusl as well. And we'll go through that in a moment. And replacing najasa that might be on the body that someone has tried to remove as much as possible, and there's still some. Let's say urine has dried on the leg, and there's no water to wash it off. It's najis on your body, right? Remaining in the masjid, if you need to go into a masjid and there's a necessity for that, then tayammum can allow you to stay there, but at minimal, like because you really are not clean to be in a masjid. Its three prerequisites are entrance of the prayer time. So you can't do tayammum. Let's say zuhur time is you need tayammum for zuhur salat. If you do tayammum like 10 minutes before zuhur time, your tayammum is not valid. You have to wait till the salat time enters for every salat, and then you make the tayammum. Absence of water due to being withheld or due to fear of physical or financial harm resulting from its usage. Whoever finds water which is not sufficient for purification is obliged to use it and then perform tayammum. Right? Straightforward. It is made with tahur, permissible unfired earth, right? It hasn't been baked in a furnace, that has dust which sticks to the hand. In its absence, one is to pray what is required as they are, not adding more than what is sufficient, not obliged to repeat it. So may Allah protect us from this. It happens to people in prisons and so forth, Allah protect, that if you can't find water, right, and you can't find dirt that you can make masa on it, dirt that you can move, like actually you can stick to your hand, then one prays without these two. He prays without wudu, without tayammum. Right, but then only praise the absolute minimum. So Allahu Akbar, Fatiha, Allahu Akbar, Subhana Rabbi al-Azim once. Sami Allahu al-Muhammad Rabbana wa lakal hamd. That's it. No more than that. Allahu Akbar, Subhana Rabbi al-A'la once, and so forth. Like the absolute minimum fard, and the only way the person can do this if they know the fard and wajib and so forth. So he does all the minimum thing, doesn't do it all, omits all the sunnah, a dua istiftah, subhanakallahumma, omits all the duas, does the absolute core salat in this condition, because this is just to fulfill the obligation, right? And there's no, he doesn't have to repeat this salat afterwards either. Its obligations include wiping the face and wiping the hands to the wrist, which I already explained. Both sequences and continuity in a minor hadith. So if you're doing tayammum for wudu, then you have to do that in order. First the face, then the hands, right? Because it's taking the place of wudu. And specifying an intention, legalizing what tayammum is being performed for, or being the hadith or najasa. An intent for one is not sufficient for the other. However, an intention for both is sufficient. Right? If you're doing for a state of impurity, like for wudu and najasa, you can do them both. It is like if you do one, it doesn't matter. It doesn't fulfill for the other. But if you do for both, it fulfills, inshallah. It is invalidated by the following. Whatever invalidates wudu. First thing. So how many things invalidated wudu? Do you remember? 8 things invalidated wudu, right? Was it 8? Yes.
Yes.
Yes, jazakallah. So 8 things those 8 things are also invalidated as tayammum as well. The time expiring. So when the salat time ends, it invalidates the tayammum. The presence of water, if tayammum was performed due to its absence. So if water appears, right? So I don't know if you heard this. A teacher explaining somebody, you know, somebody was giving a sheikh was giving khutbah, and the guy walks in at the wrong time and he hears the khatib saying something along the lines, when you see the donkey, your wudu breaks. Right? Or your tayammum breaks. And this guy said, like, what kind of sheikh is this? Like, he's talking nonsense. You know, he's standing on the minbar and telling people such a ridiculous thing. What he didn't hear was before, you know, the whole topic, which was that the man's water was on a donkey and he was in the desert. He got lost. His transport got lost. His donkey got lost. The water is gone. So now he's met tayammum. Now he's in a state of tayammum. As soon as he sees the donkey, what happens? His wudu breaks, like his tayammum breaks. But when you don't have the whole story behind it, then yeah, so we should hear the whole story from beginning, you know. The termination of what permitted it. So it could be like an enemy or something harmful, whatever sickness, maybe a sickness is preventing a person from making wudu, or the removal of what was wiped over. The removal of what was wiped over is referring to, remember we learned about masa on splints, masa on khufain, masa on turban, right? If you take that off, imagine you put leather sock, you've done tayammum, you put khuf on, right? So you got tayammum, you did zuhr salat, right? And you did tayammum for zuhr, and you prayed your zuhr. Then after zuhr, you're in a state of tayammum, right? Instead of wudu, like you can read Quran and you can do other nafl prayers, etc. And then you put leather socks on, and then you took them off. What happens when you do when you took your khuf off? I mentioned earlier. If you take your khuf off, what happens? It breaks your wudu, right? It breaks your wudu. So if you remove, right? If you remove the khuf, yeah, wudu breaks. So your wudu breaks. So although the feet have nothing to do with tayammum, but because the tayammum is taking the place of wudu, the same rulings apply. Same with the turban. If you make wudu, or if you make tayammum and you put a turban on after and you remove it, the tayammum breaks because it's taking the place of wudu. All right. Removal of najasa. 7 washes are required for everything contaminated by najasa. In the Arabic, the word that is used is mutanajis, not najis, the thing that is contaminated by najasa. So in the Hanbali Mazhab, one of the specific rulings of the Hanbali Mazhab, we went through a few today about the leather and so forth, but one that is specific that is not in the other three schools, three mothers of the Ahlul Sunnah wal Jama'ah, is washing 7 times for all najasa. It's not just for dogs, right? It's not just for pig, khanzir. All najasa. So if you have najasa on your clothes, let's say urine, it has to be washed 7 times. Dipped in water, squeeze outside, dipped in water, squeeze outside, dipped in, squeeze outside because there's najasa in it, right? 7 times. So this is applicable to all najasa. However, there is a strong view in the school, like the other madhab, 3 times. There's different riwayat. The riwayat that is there in the Hanbali Mazhab is considered weak. It's attributed to Abdullah bin Umar radiallahu anhu that we were taught to wash 7 times. So that's the Imam Ahmad has taken that view. And this is to wash seven other madahib have the view of three times, if I remember correctly. In the Hanbali Mazhab, it is seven times. Probably a way to do it is like generally you wash our clothes where? In washing machines. If you want to wash our clothes, maybe the way to do it is wash the najasa part outside and then put it with the clothes in the washing machine. Because I'm not sure, depending on how many cycles you have in your washing machine, generally our washing machine cycle have three or few cycles. Try not to put najas things into the washing machine. Wallahu alam. That meaning that the najas has been removed, or wash it separately and use extra cycles. Wallahu alam. This will maintain the madhab of the, like the practice of the madhab. If not, then it is washed until purified with tahur water, coupled with scratching and scrubbing if needed, as long as the location is not damaged. And like it's not so rigorous that the clothes are, that the clothes, for example, are damaged. Why he mentions scratching and scrubbing? Because one, scratching refers to that which is dry, and scrubbing would refer to something that which is wet, right? So sometimes najasa is got moisture in it, sometimes it's totally dried, right? And wringing an absorbent material outside of the water source. As I mentioned, that you take it, you put the water on it, then you take it and squeeze it somewhere else, like in the drain, right? After every wash, I don't know if any of you still have the skill of washing with your hands in 2023. I'm just trying to find the right slide on my notes. One of the washes must be done with tahur earth if the soil object was contaminated by a dog or a swine. One of the washes must be done with tahur. So there you go. That's the one of the seventh. The remaining taste is detrimental, but not a color, smell, or both, if difficult to remove. Right. So the taste of najasa, I mean, it's kind of sounds strange, but what it's trying to say, these are the way tests are done, right? That it's not saying to go taste, but there's that much there that if you were to put your tongue on it, you would taste something. Smell and color is the effect of najasa left. Even after washing, sometimes smell remains very hard to get rid of, right? And the color, like for example, blood stained, like if you wash cloth and there's a stain of blood on a piece of cloth, then the color is there, that's fine. I'm not talking about the actual substance of the blood, the stain of the blood, the color. Same thing with the smell. The smell could be there, could be overpowering, strong smell. But if you were to taste it, let's say hypothetically to taste that najasa, then nothing would be tasted, meaning that the physical impurity actually has been removed. So the taste is detrimental, meaning you still have to keep washing it until it disappears. If you washed it seven times and the najasa is still there, then you have to keep washing it until it's gone, right? But you should be washing more than, you wash it until it's removed if it's more than seven. It is sufficient to douse the urine of a baby boy who has yet to eat food due to craving with water until soaked. So there's an exception made specifically in the hadith you mentioned about a baby boy. That a baby boy, not a baby girl, that is under the age of two, meaning his age is still drinking milk, he has not eaten any food yet, that just to soak their area, meaning not to wash it, drench it with water. And there's different reasons given why baby boy, not a baby girl. You know, some different explanation given that the boy even urinates, he sprays it everywhere. So many young, but however, at the end, it's the action of Rasulullah Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, and we do it according to what he has taught us or what he did. Rocks, basins, and land which have been soiled by liquid, even that of a dog or a swine, are to be sprayed within a bath. So this is now talking about other than the body or things that absorb najasa. It's talking about like land or the ground, anything that najasa has come onto. All you have to do is just soak it with, it says spray, but soak it with water until its color, smell are removed. So for example, let's say you got a tiled floor and there's najasa on it. Just wash it. Or for example, if it's outside, you hose it usually until it's gone. or until its color and smell are removed, as long as it is not impossible to remove one or the other. If the water is still present, that is on the baby, a boy's urine or land, etc., they become purified even with the presence of the water. Right. Let's look at the Arabic. Yeah, the water that is the water that washed it. So the water that washed it, if it's still there, it's fine. Right? And this is based on the hadith of the Bedouin who came and urinated in the masjid. Rasulullah said, just pour a bucket of water over it. Just pour a bucket of water on it. So it is meaning that it diluted and it's not considered something of grave consequence. Right? So, but this is not najasa that's on the body or clothes. This is najasa that's externally on somewhere else. And the boy one is, it can be on clothes, but it just has to be drenched or soaked. Okay. Land is not purified by the sun, wind, or dew drying. So sun drying in the sun doesn't purify land, neither does the wind, or it just dries by itself. Najas is not purified with fire. If so, its ash is najas. Alcohol is purified when it naturally turns to vinegar or due to moving it without intending acidification. Its container is similar. I don't know if any of the brothers there or sisters, if they know about in terms of vinegar. I was trying to read the Shafi'i fatwa earlier that if vinegar is made, and the reason for this is that it closes the door of people are taking alcohol. So you're not even allowed to have alcohol, let alone drink it. And if you have alcohol, according to the mother, you can't even have alcohol in your possession. To make the vinegar from such a source would require you to take alcohol into possession or purchase it, which in itself is not valid, right? So now you have a problem. How do you make vinegar then? How is vinegar made? Like, is there a, generally, I know that a lot of it is, I was reading about it earlier, and some, I was actually in the middle of reading and class had to start. Shafi'i ulama probably have, they have the same ruling as well. Then where do you get your vinegar from? We should ask the Shafi'is about that. If najasa is concealed, it must be washed until it has surely been properly cleaned. Yeah, that's straightforward. And this is the last, lines. Yeah, last one. Liquid intoxicants, so like wine, as well as, sorry, some comments. Yeah, well, vinegar is generally made, if you go in Australia in a shopping center, there's red wine vinegar, white wine vinegar. So it's actually wine. And if you leave the process of fermentation continue, then it becomes vinegar. There's a process, right? In the Hanbali Mazhab, if it's done by human action, then it's not valid. You're not allowed to consume it. If it happens by itself, let's say somebody left the bottle outside accidentally or somewhere, it fermented, became wine, and then it by itself without human interference. That would be tahir and halal to consume. But if it's done through a process of a process with human interference, then it would not be, I'm not sure how much percentage of the vinegars in our supermarkets are from this source or that source. How actually the process, maybe it's a good, another thing to probably add to find out, inshallah. Vinegar, because we do have it in our houses in Australia. A lot of us use it. What would be the halal version of it? Liquid intoxicants like wine, as well as birds and beets that are inedible and physically larger than cat, are najis. Right? So birds and beets. So, for example, like a vulture is a big bird. Right? It's bigger than a cat, but the size matters. And beasts. Right, let's say a tiger, which is bigger than a cat, obviously, they are najis. Every carcass besides humans fish and locusts are najis. Every body, right? Every carcass. I'm just curious what the Arabic was of the original. Yeah, it says carcass, but actually every carrion, probably better to say, because carcass can be from halal as well. Carrion from every carrion, besides humans, fish and locusts. Human because they had a shut off of being human being. Fish and locusts, other than human beings, fish and locusts, they're all najis. Every animal that is died in a is all najis. Every carrion is najis. A small amount per custom of dirt from the road, which is known to be najis, is overlooked. Otherwise, it is tahir. So if you know that a roadway, a path, it's got mud, like this doesn't really apply today much. Historically, there weren't built-up roads and stone roads or paved roads. Caravans as you travel, animal droppings were there and so forth. You know, like it was a constant, like it was not clean. The mud was not clean. I was reading in a book with our teacher in Bukhara, and these cities, they were called these the Silk Road cities. There's a lot of traffic on these roads, animals and human beings, and there's a lot of mud, and it was unavoidable. The mud was unavoidable. So if you go from out of your house to the mosque in public area, you'll get mud on your clothes. So it's a very, very normal thing to get dirty. So if the road is known to be najis, like sewage might have flowed into it, and the whole area has become najis, put it that way. So there's now sewage that has flowed into the street, let's say, and that mud is there for weeks on end and so forth, then it will be najis, right? But a small amount per custom, what's considered like a small amount is excused, right? If you know in the dirt, it's dirt, but it's got najasa mixed into it. Otherwise, it is is overlooked. Otherwise, it is tahir, meaning that if there's no najis on the road, just normal dirt, if you get like 1 kilo of mud from normal dirt and just it's on your clothes everywhere, it's dried on your clothes, it's muddy, it's dusty, but it's tahir, so it's not najis. Right. Only that which is known to be najis. The leftovers of a tahir animal are not disliked. Right? That is their excess food and drink, except for that of non-sequestered, like animals that are basically they run in the streets, chickens and mice. Right? So these are the everyday animals that live with human beings. So the excess food and drink of a, if they eat from your food or they, if they eat from your food, these animals are, they're considered tahir. So the leftover tahir animals are not disliked. That is their excess food, the leftover food and drink, except for that of non-sequestered chickens. So generally chickens is a very common animal that is kept. It eats sometimes, the non-sequestered mean they're not kept in home. They go in the streets, they'll find filth, they'll eat anything, they're fine, put their head in anything. And then they come and they eat, like drink water that you're drinking from. And mice, because mice are known, they touch everything. If a cat, because of high possibility they are, if a cat or a child were to eat najasa and then drink from a small amount of water, it would be considered tahir even if before leaving. Right? So then, yeah, that small, if that animal were to leave, then that last sentence, I don't know. I read it before. I was actually listening to my teacher's commentary on it as well. Brother Ahmed, do you remember what that last masala is? It slipped my mind. I actually was reading it earlier. Listened to my sheikh's dars on this. Is Brother Ahmed here? He's here. Just give me one moment. Let me just... I think that was the last masala for today. I can just add it to a list for next week, inshallah. that's it, inshallah, I think, for today. I mean, a lot of these masajid. No, there's actually one more to do with. Sorry, apologies. There actually is one more slide. I'll just finish the slides first and I'll answer the question after. The earliest age of menstruation is 9 and the latest is 50. A pregnant woman does not menstruate. It's short. If she has any bleeding, that's called istihada. That's irregular bleeding, but she's not in a state of haid or anything else. Its shortest period is 1 day and night and longest is 15 days. Most of the time it is 6 or 7, like on average is 6 or 7. The shortest period of purity between two menstrual cycles is 13 days. Most of the time it is the remainder of the month. There is no limit on how long it can be. It can go for 6 months, it can go for years. There are ladies like extreme athletes, like they can go for a very long time without, because of the huge exertion placed in the body. It is impermissible for her to perform prayer. Does not have to be made up, but the fasts have to be made up. That's talking about Farad fast, the Ramadan fast, or to have intercourse with her, which requires, so intercourse is forbidden during Hayd. If it is done, then it requires 1 or half a dinar as an expiation. I was checking how much a dinar is. I think it's like 370 Australian dollars. It's 4.25 grams is 1 dinar or 1 mithqal. And half of that, 2.125 is the half. Why the two values are narrated? One value is referring to at the beginning of the Hayd, if intercourse is done, and one is the half is referring to the end of the Hayd. Still in Hayd, but so it's forbidden. Other intimate acts are, however, permitted. All types of intimacy and so forth are permitted. Nifas is, or postpartum bleeding has no limit. And it, on its shortest duration, its maximum is 40 days. I mean, the baby can be born immediately if fast can finish. It is ruled as such that whenever is whatever is delivered possesses human characteristic. So the hukum of nifas will apply when the fetus that is delivered, or obviously fetus will be is passed away, then that fetus, if you look at it, there are human, like fingers or limbs can be seen. Becoming clean during its duration is considered purity during that 40 days. Intercourse during it is disliked. It is, meaning it's in tuhur, but intercourse is makruh in this time. It's considered, like tuhur is the opposite of being in hayd or nifas. It is treated like menstruation in its ruling, except for both the marital waiting period, the iddah, does not, remember the iddah, the waiting period for a divorcee lady is 3 menstrual cycles. And of course, the hukum of maturity being baligh is not applicable to nifas. That's impossible because a child doesn't come out of, or a young person, a girl doesn't reach the, doesn't have nifas as a starting of her cycles. That's it. Jazakumullah khaira. Bulugh al-Maram is not a Hanbali fiqh text. It's a hadith collection of ahkam. So for a woman, no, not in the mazhab, no. For a woman to read the Quran from memory, sorry, when you say from memory, do you mean from memory or in your memory? Are you saying by heart or by in your mind? So she can go through the ayat in her mind. Yeah, no, in the Hanbali madhab, you cannot read. In the 3, I think the Malikis give some leeway, but the in the Hanbali madhab, there is it's haram to read it while in a state of Hayd. The brother was asking about Zad al-Mustaqni'. Yeah, I mean, there are different syllabi suggested by different mashayikh. Some do everything, like in terms of, but basically in fiqh, if you can get a, this is what I would suggest, this level of study, like in terms of this type of course and the masail covered, generally in a sort of Darul Uloom or madrasa system, we would probably put this as a pre-idadiyah, like a pre-alim course subject, or maybe the first 6 months, right? Generally in madaris, we study in English here in Australia. Our madrasa, I teach in the madrasa as well. that the first 6 months we're covering in English just to help get all the students on the same page. Then after that, all the texts are in Arabic. So Bidayat al-Abid, so what I previously had thought, Bidayat al-Abid and the Ajwa al-Jaliya as a first year ilm in a 6 year, a 5 year syllabus, let's say, put it that way. So this would be like the first 6-5 months, but the students have to memorize all the masail. And they're also learning Arabic as well. They're starting to read the Arabic because it's doing like 10 other subjects. So if you put it like that, if you put like a 4-level syllabus, then Dr. Sheikh Adnan, my teacher, Dr. Mutlaq's teacher, he has a certain syllabus. He said at this level, study X, A, B, C. At level two, study A, you know, 1, 2, 3. At level three. So there's like, basically you can take like 4 levels of books. So Dr. Mutlaq, the syllabus that he generally, he gives Bidayat al-Abid, then Umda, Imam Buhuti, then commentary of that, Hidayat al-Raghib, and then he suggests Al-Muntaha, if I remember correctly, these are the four. So these are generally considered like 4-level study, but in each level, there are other books you can study. There's multiple books you can study. So Zad will make an appearance, its commentary makes an appearance, Dalil al-Talib makes an appearance, Dalil al-Talib, Aqsar al-Mukhtasarat, Rawd al-Murbi', Shar al-Muntaha. Yeah, this is one, this could be, so Ajwa al-Jaliya. Ajwa al-Jaliya is what I was teaching madrasa. I'm not saying Bidayat al-Abid. Dr. Mutlaq, he suggests Bidayat al-Abid, and then Umda, and then the commentary Umda, Hidayat al-Raghib, and the Muntaha. This is one. The thing is that Umda ibn Qudama is not a standardized text of the Mutakhirin, the later Hanbalis. And because the Madhab refined, because he's a huge figure, but and it's an amazing book, Al-Umda. It was a Middle Ages syllabus book. But of course, you will learn from that book, but I haven't seen in any, as far as I know, I've seen the ulama teach from it. But is it a syllabus like text in the sense it wasn't Middle Ages? It was his syllabus, Ibn Qudam al-Maqdisi, rahmullah. But people do teach it, like they do teach it. So, but it requires notes. And what I'm saying is that the later, we run out of time, but the later Hanbalis, they've processed Ibn Qudama's works and everything, Kafi. And so I had the pleasure to study Al-Kafi with my father, rahimullah, which is the third, after Umda, which is like the third text before Mughni. Mughni is, I don't know how you study that, but I had the honor to read that with my father, rahimullah. Yeah, the later era is the school is refined, and I think that's the mutaakhirin. We have to go through them. If we're studying a madhab, we have to study through the whole package. Like you go through the whole, you start with the ones that are recent teachers, and they take you through that journey through the whole school right up to the imam. My advice is, I've gone over the time, 5 minutes over the time. And my advice on because the brothers asked me direct questions, so I don't know why you don't ask in the group so others can benefit, because then I'm answering after mentioning your questions. You're looking for something to study after Bidayat al-Abid, which explains on YouTube. I'm not sure. Sheikh Starling, John Starling, I think he's done some works. You might have to look at that. But my advice, isn't there? Okay, khair. Apologies. I think you have to learn Arabic. This is the easiest way. Yeah, brother Ahmed has mentioned that John Starling has playlists on Ajuba, Bidayat al-Abid, Dalil al-Talib, Mashallah, Mbarik Ali. Like he's done a lot of things. Sometimes I feel like not doing anything. I said to some guy doing it, it's recorded, inshallah, it's there for posterity, for the long term, inshallah. That sometimes you feel like, okay, we don't need to do anything. Everyone else can go home. So he does a good job, alhamdulillah. Lumat al-Itiqad, this is Aqaid books and Al-Qalaid al-Aqiyan, yeah. So he's done other works, alhamdulillah. Yeah, I think the thing is that there is no such thing as really through the English language, like a graded syllabus. You'll have one book like Bidayat al-Abid, or now there's so many translations available. Sheikh Musa Ferber has done so many translations as well. But I think for a non-alim, a person who's not studying Arabic or other sciences that help you, like madrasas, within 6 months they're studying Arabic texts. I'm developing a course at the moment, inshallah ta'ala bidnillah, how to read a fiqh book in Arabic within 30 lessons. I wrote, designed the first lesson the other day because based on something was mentioned last week. This is an idea that's been brooding in my mind for a while, but it requires many ingredients to be put together. That's Arabic for fiqh, not Arabic for Quran. You'll be able to read Quran, inshallah, benefit of Quran. But like, you know, in university, there are courses in English for engineering, English for medicine, English. You have these courses, right? If you're studying a specific department, you're not required to learn all of English and Shakespeare and everything. You're learning English for a purpose. I think a course designed for Arabic, no, they're not created yet. Like, these are not easy things to do. Like, make dua, inshallah, for me that I can get tawfiq to do this. I mentioned to the organizers. Did I miss something? The vinegar. I don't remember. No. Oh, okay. I don't know. No, we just mentioned about the vinegar. The vinegar slide? Yeah. I'm not sure what you're referring to. Any other questions before we wrap up? We've gone over the time again. 1 hour and 40 minutes now, almost getting. We'll leave it at that, inshallah. Yeah, the admin, if you can make sure, I'll message them again. They have the recording.
Yeah, Sheikh, I am working on recording is properly uploaded on the platform.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I'm not doing it, so somebody else. Sorry, who's speaking?
Admin.
Oh, okay, Jazakallah khair. Sorry, I couldn't see it. Okay, so it's uploaded already, the first one?
Yes, yes.
Okay, alhamdulillah, good. There you go. And Ahmed, you have one last thing to say? You put a question up. I'll just see if I can answer it before I let you go. Just trying to find the slide. Which is known to be najis is overlooked. Otherwise, it is so. What was mentioned after this? I'm trying to find the spot. Oh, here we go. After that was on the slide was the leftover of tahir animals, are not disliked. The su'ur. Yeah, inshallah. After that was the tahir animals, like the leftovers of tahir animals are not disliked. So I'll just finish off with this. And yeah, the leftover of tahir animals. That's what we. All right. And generally, we don't have to worry about these things, unless a cat drinks out of your cup or something. All right, let's leave it there. Barakallahu feekum, jazakumullah khair for attending today. Inshallah, I will see you next week. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Wa iyakum.